Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to the February 2017 edition of First Thursday. This is Labor Relations Information Systems monthly podcast on recent developments in the public safety labor relations world. My name is Will Aitchison, and for the next 45 minutes or so, I'll be taking you through some matters of interest over the last 30 days. But first, I want to answer a question that we get from time to time. And the question is, where does all this stuff come from? Where do all these cases come from? How do you find them and everything like that? I know there's an old adage that the whole world cares about the baby and isn't terribly interested in the labor pains. And I know this is sort of the labor pains of putting together this podcast, but I thought I'd spend a minute or two and talk to you about how we put this together, how we choose the topics that we do, and how you can suggest topics for us to cover. So from our standpoint, this all starts with our newsletter. Labor Relations Information System publishes a monthly newsletter. It's called Public Safety Labor News. It's a paper newsletter. And in order to research that newsletter, we have to look at an awful lot of cases. Every month, I write 18 or so articles for that newsletter. And in order to get to those 18 articles, I try to read every published case, federal or state case in the country, involving firefighters or police or deputies or correctional officers, anybody involved in the public safety world. That work all starts with Mark Fuller of LRAS. You've heard me mention Mark's name from time to time. He's Mr. Tech at LRIS. Every day he runs a search string or gets the results of search strings that we have saved in our legal database. We use Westlaw. There are others, but we could use Westlaw. And that search string or that series of search strings is calculated to bring in as many possible cases as you can bring in about public safety labor relations. And typically, we're reading these cases a day or two or three after they have been decided. Now, trust me, when you're setting up search strings for every appellate court and many trial courts in the country, you're going to get a lot of stuff that you don't want to see. And it's Mark's job to bring that stuff down to a manageable load, and then he sends me the cases, and I read through the cases. How many cases? Depends on the day, but I'm probably reading, and I'll put that word reading in quotes because I'm skimming them, anywhere from 10 on a light day to maybe as many as 50 cases a day, trying to figure out what's worthwhile and what's not worthwhile. After you've done this for a while, making that judgment, what gets into the 18 articles that we put in the newsletter, that gets a little bit easier. I can pretty much guarantee you, every single day, there is going to be what I think of as a disparate treatment case. And a disparate treatment case is where an employee thinks that they have been the victim of disparate treatment because of their presence in a protected class. And the protected class might be race, it might be gender, it might be religion, it might be because they've engaged in free speech or whistleblowing activity or something like that. And the courts have a very familiar analysis as to how they look at those cases. It's kind of a shifting burden of proof, and eventually the employee has to prove that the employer's reason for doing whatever it is the employer did, usually terminate the employee, that reason is pretextual. And 99 times out of 100, the employee is unable to meet that burden of proof. But once you've read your first 10 or 20 or 30 of those cases, you get to start to recognize patterns, and you don't need to read all of them. Once you've read your 500th of those cases, you've probably read enough of them, and you're looking for the exceptions. You're looking for that odd sort of case in this little micro example I'm giving you, a disparate treatment case, that odd sort of case that seems to raise something new. For example, might it be religious discrimination to have a dress code that bans beards because not cutting facial hair is part of the religious tenets of several religions that public safety officers follow from time to time. And so that might make that interesting. Eventually, we put together this newsletter, the 18 cases or so that go into the newsletter. What I do is I summarize the cases. We don't publish the cases themselves. I summarize them and cut and paste, and some might argue hack at the cases, but put them all together. We also have some other features in the newsletter. For example, we try to track all reported contract settlements involving public safety employees, police, fire, corrections. We have a section that we call Contracts in the News where we print some of the more significant settlements that are out there. You may have wondered how it is that we are guessing that the wages for law enforcement officers in 2017, that those wage settlements will be somewhere between 0.3% and 0.5% higher than those for firefighters. Well, we do it based upon this miniature little database that we create that involve contracts in the news. We have a couple of other tables in this newsletter that never make it onto the podcast. The first one is for those of you who are in collective bargaining world and want to know what's negotiable and why or why not. We have a table on what we think of as scope of bargaining. Is this topic mandatory for bargaining? So we've had a lot of litigation lately over firefighter staffing, minimum staffing for firefighters. And over on the law enforcement side, a lot of litigation over body cameras and whether changes in these practices are mandatory for bargaining and if so, what that means. What are the implications of something being a mandatory subject of bargaining? And so we will put all these things into the table and hopefully create something that's pretty useful, a useful reference to look at. The last thing that's in the newsletter is we have a section on disciplinary cases. As you can imagine, we have far too many discipline cases in order to print everything. We end up only printing usually about three or four. And the ones that we select to put in this table are those that represent, I think, a pretty good principle of one of the sub-principles of just cause for discipline. So, for example, I'm looking at the table that we published in our February 2017 Public Safety Labor News. And this is a police case, and it involved a sergeant who violated his department. He worked for the city of West Miami, Florida. His department's work rules on the length of rest periods was taking too much time on his breaks and spending too little time on preventative patrol. He ended up getting terminated for that. This was an arbitrator's opinion. The arbitrator put him back to work. And the arbitrator's rationale was that the employer had failed to discipline three sergeants who had done exactly the same things and had not issued a notice to the members of the bargaining unit that it intended to strictly enforce its rest period and preventative patrol rules. Well, that's a basic principle of just cause, right? That if you set a past practice with respect to discipline as an employer, you're not free to vary from that except in extraordinary circumstances, unless you've given employees notice that you intend to do so. The last feature of our Public Safety Labor News is we have a map that shows projected rates or actual rates of increase in the Consumer Price Index. So you know we're now running at a national CPI that is about 2%. Projections are likely to be the same thing. So how does all that about the newsletter play into these podcasts? And here's the way it does, is the podcast cases that I talk about typically, not always, are in the newsletter. I will only usually review three or at most four cases in the podcast. So there's a whole bunch of cases in the newsletter that I don't select for the podcast. I put the ones in the podcast because I think they may have interesting facts or that allow us to spin off into different directions from a legal standpoint to show how a case might have come out differently if this happened or that happened or things like that. Now, I mentioned at the outset of this that you can influence what goes into the podcast. You can also influence what goes into the newsletter. And that's by sending us your cases. We love to get your cases. Most labor decisions involving public safety employees are not publicly reported. We may be reading this 10, 20, 30, or 50 cases a day, but that's a smidgen of how many cases are actually decided every day. And there are several of you from around the country who, God bless you, send us in your decisions. Keep them coming. We absolutely love it. One of my favorite correspondents is an attorney from a northern Midwest state. She hasn't given me permission to use her name, but you know who you are, and thank you for sending us all the cases. By sending us cases and sending us topics that you want us to talk about, you'll influence how these podcasts go. And as I mentioned, it all starts with reading all these cases, which also become part of our recent developments outline that we hand out at our seminars. All of that feeds, first of all, into the newsletter and then into the podcast. So that's how this all is put together. I promise you, I won't say that again. Now, on to the cases. All right. After disparaging disparate treatment cases in that introduction, of course, I want to start off with a disparate treatment case. This is one that comes out of Camden County, New Jersey, and it's a correctional facility that is there, and it involves a woman by the name of Linda Tisby. Tisby's a corrections officer, been a corrections officer for a long time, since 2002. At one point in time, she was Sunni Muslim, and she lapsed in that belief, but in 2015, reverted to the Sunni Muslim faith. And on May 1st, 2015, she reported to work wearing, for the first time ever, what's known as a khaimar. A khaimar is a traditional Muslim garb. In this case, it is a tight-fitting head covering. It doesn't have a veil, but it's a tight-fitting covering, kind of like a scarf, scarf-like piece of clothing. Tisby's supervisor said, no, you're out of compliance with our uniform policy, and you can't work unless you remove the khaimar. Tisby says, no. I am not going to remove it. It violates my religious principles. And she gets sent home. And disciplinary charges were recommended by the supervisor. This happens again. The first time it happened was on May 1. It happened again on May 2, on May 3, and May 6. Each day, Tisby shows up in her khaimar. Each day, she's told to remove it or go home. Each day, she says, I'm not going to remove it because of my religion, and she gets sent home, and discipline is implemented. Eventually, after the May 6th event, Tisby gets a two-day suspension. Let me interject something right here. This is an employee. Let's forget the religious discrimination implications of this. Let's just focus on the pure insubordination element of it. This is an employee who four times over the course of four work days, has disobeyed the direct order of her supervisor to do something. And for that, she gets a two-day suspension. Boy, I don't know. At least in our neck of the woods up here in the Northwest, I'm not sure you'd still be an employee by the fourth time you told your supervisor, I am not going to do something, and the fourth time you were sent home over the course of a work week. Okay, editorial done. A few days later, the warden issues a memorandum, and the warden is kind of thoughtful, and the warden clearly has consulted with counsel, because the warden tells Tisby, I'm going to consider your position as a request for reasonable accommodation under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, as well as New Jersey's state law analog, which is known as the Law Against Discrimination in New Jersey. I'm going to treat it as a request for accommodation, even though you haven't submitted such a request. The warden then goes on to say, look, I don't have any reason to question whether or not you have sincerely held religious beliefs. I'm going to assume that you do, but we're not going to accommodate you. And we're not going to accommodate you because it would be an undue hardship to the department to allow officers to wear head coverings or other non-uniform clothing. And the warden warns Tisby in no uncertain terms that she's going to be subject to discipline up to and including discharge if she comes to work in other than the permitted uniform. Let me interject another kind of editorial note here, or at least observation. What's the warden talking about with respect to reasonable accommodation? We think of reasonable accommodation easily in the context of the Americans with Disabilities Act and people who have disabilities. It's not quite as well known that that principle of religious accommodation applies to a whole host of federal workplace statutes. And one of them is Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and the extent to which Title VII applies to religions. There is an obligation on the part of employers to reasonably accommodate the bona fide religious beliefs of employees. That's why, for example, when you see union dues provisions in state laws, that's why you always find religious exemptions for that. Now, the obligation to reasonably accommodate somebody's religious beliefs isn't unlimited. The boundaries of it are set by whether or not, and the warden got the phrase exactly right, whether or not the accommodation would constitute an undue hardship. And most of these questions of undue hardship for accommodating religions, most of them center on one of two things. And the first is workplace safety. You don't have to accommodate a religious belief if the employer is able to articulate workplace safety concerns. And secondly, a union contract. You don't have to accommodate religious beliefs if to do so would cause the employer to violate a union contract. No union contract involved here, but some of those union contract cases are pretty fascinating. I think the leading case comes out of Nevada, Clark County Sheriff's Office Carson City Sheriff's Office. Carson City is the capital of Nevada. It's a combined city-county police agency. There, the main case on reasonable accommodation of religious beliefs came with a new deputy who was hired, who, after she was hired, said, oh, by the way, I'm a Jehovah's Witness, I think it was Jehovah's Witness, and I can't work Saturdays. Well, shifts were bid there in the sheriff's department on the basis of seniority, and the newbie, the newest hired police officer / deputy sheriff, has the least seniority and is least likely to get weekends off. The employer said, I'm not going to accommodate this because I'd have to violate the union contract, the seniority provision in the union contract. Goes to the Ninth Circuit. Ninth Circuit says it's undue hardship for an employer to have to violate a union contract, so there's no need for reasonable accommodation. So that's an example for you of how reasonable accommodation can run into the whole issue of union contracts and particularly seniority. The other area I mentioned is safety. That's where Tisby's case comes. She files a lawsuit and files it under both Title VII and the New Jersey Law Against Discrimination, and it ends up before the New Jersey Court of Appeals. And the New Jersey Court does, I think, a pretty good job of picking up many of the law enforcement cases involving dress codes and, in particular, head coverings. And the main case here is one out of the City of Philadelphia Police Department, where an officer requested permission to wear a headscarf while on duty for religious reasons, and the city won. And the court said, look, in law enforcement, there's a value to uniformity in appearance, but even if there wasn't, there are safety implications to this. And that is exactly the way Tisby's case comes out in New Jersey. Here's what the court says, and I'll read you, I think it's just going to be a couple of sentences here. We do not minimize the religious significance of the chimar for the women who wear them, and we recognize a compelling sense of religious obligation in the decision to wear a chimar. However, after weighing the safety concerns, including the safety risk and ability to hide contraband in head coverings, as well as the necessity of uniform neutrality, we conclude that the employer met its burden of establishing that accommodation was a hardship. And you can see the obvious safety concerns with a head covering in a correctional facility, right? The ability of an inmate to grab the head covering where otherwise there might not be quite the same purchase on hair. And of course, the ability to hide contraband in head coverings. This is a case that doesn't have an unexpected result. You could read these facts and you could predict that Tisby was going to lose. But these are cases that come up more and more and more. These requests for religious accommodations that run headlong into a public safety employer's grooming code. Most of those challenges made by employees lose. Not all. We talked about last month, we talked about the New York Police Department accommodating the desire of Sikh police officers to wear very small beards. Not all of them lose, but most of them do because of these concerns of safety, union contracts, and the need for uniformity of appearance. Now for the case that more of you have asked that we talk about than really any case in memory. It's a Fourth Circuit case. Fourth Circuit is the Federal Court of Appeals that's in on the Eastern Seaboard in kind of the middle of the country. The head of the Fourth Circuit is in Virginia. And this is a social media case involving a couple of police officers for the city of Petersburg, Virginia. And the court ends up overturning their discipline. And the case got an awful lot of attention. It circulated through a number of blogs and Facebook posts, got an awful lot of attention. I think not so much for the fact that it really made new law, because I don't think the case made new law at all, but because it's one of the more, I think, prominent cases. The buildup to this case has been so long that it's been one of the more prominent cases that have been around, and a lot of people have been watching it. Okay, so what goes on in this case? Well, in April of 2013, the police chief for Petersburg, Virginia, issues a new general order, and this is revising the department's social networking policy. And the new general order and the new policy are just about as broad as they could possibly be. The new policy prohibits the dissemination of any information, and get ready, this is a quote, that would tend to discredit or reflect unfavorably upon the department or any other City of Petersburg department or its employees. Think about that for a moment. This prohibits a police officer working for the City of Petersburg from saying, among other things, I think the police budget is too low, or I think the city, in making a decision about whether or not it should have an additional park, should take some additional considerations into mind. All of that could reflect unfavorably on any City of Petersburg department or its employees. This is a gaping wide policy. Now, the policy goes on to explicitly ban what it defines as negative comments. And these are negative comments are, in the words of the policy, comments on the internal operations of the Bureau or specific conduct of supervisors or peers that impacts the public's perception of the department. Whoa, really? Think about that for a moment. It defines as negative comments, comments on the internal operations of the department or the conduct of supervisors or peers that impacts the public perceptions of the department. Not negatively impacts, impacts the public perception of the department. There's another provision in this social media policy that allows officers to comment on issues of public concern only so long as the comments don't disrupt the workforce, interfere with important working relationships or efficient workflow, or undermine public confidence in the officer. Well, think about that for a moment. Let's say an officer has a Facebook page off duty, and the officer's Facebook page ends up advocating that the United Kingdom reconsider its Brexit vote. Could that undermine public confidence of, say, one member of the public of Petersburg in the officer? Maybe. And that would be at least a technical violation of the social media policy. So what we've got here is a social media policy that is clearly written to, I think, shut down the ability of off-duty police officers from being on social media whatsoever. Or if they get on social media, they do so at their risk. Well, of course, these are police officers and this is social media, so they proceed to do so at their risk, right? And one of the people who comments on social media is a guy named Herbert Liverman. And Liverman's a veteran officer for the department. And after this new policy is in place, he posts this message on his Facebook page. And I'm quoted, "Sitting here reading posts referencing rookie cops becoming instructors. Give me a freaking break. Over 15 years of data collected by the FBI in reference to assaults on officers and officer deaths shows that on average it takes at least 5 years for an officer to acquire the necessary skill set to know the job and perhaps even longer to acquire the knowledge to teach other officers. But in today's world of instant gratification and political correctness, we have rookies in specialty units working as field training officers and even instructors. Becoming a master of your trade is essential. Not only does your life depend upon it, but more importantly, the lives of others. Leadership is first learning, knowing, and then doing." That's the comment. It doesn't criticize the Petersburg, doesn't mention the Petersburg Police Department, right? It just talks about this whole notion of rookie police officers becoming instructors. That's going on around the country, right? As we lose a generation of officers and as we're facing this hiring crisis, the result is that we have employees with 2, 3, and 4 years of service becoming field training officers. That's going on all over the country, and veteran officers grumble and grump about that all the time. Liverman is doing it on Facebook. Off duty, but he's doing it on Facebook. Well, his post gets a whole bunch of likes, and one of the likes is from one of his fellow veteran officers, Vance Richards. And Richards, who's also off duty on the time, at the time, comes in with this comment, or call it a grump. I don't know. I grump about things all the time, so I think I can use that word. Here's Richards. "Well said, bro. I agree 110%. Not to mention you're seeing more and more younger officers being promoted to supervisor. It's disgusting. Makes me sick to my stomach. Daily, law enforcement supervisors should be promoted by experience. And what comes with experience are experiences that they can pass around to the rookies and less experienced officers. As a police vet who knew, tried telling and warning the administration for promoting the young rookie who was too experienced, I'm with you, bruh. SMH. Later that day, Leverman responds to Richards and says more of the same, and then Richards comes back and ends up saying, you're right again, the next 4 years can't get here fast enough. I guess Richards is within 4 years of retirement. From what I'm seeing, I don't think it can last, though. You know the old but true saying, your agency is only as good as its leaders. It's hard to lead by example when there isn't one. Now finally we get some direct criticism of the department, right? And doesn't call out the police chief by name, but I think we all know who Richards is talking about. Well, that's waving a red flag in front of the bull, and the bull in this case is the chief. And the chief issues an oral reprimand to both of those officers and puts them on 6 months probation. By the way, the unions are illegal in Virginia. There's a decision of the Virginia Supreme Court from many years ago that holds that public sector unions are illegal. There's no union contracts, there's no just cause provisions for public safety employees in Virginia. If you were in a union environment, is it a possible disciplinary sanction to put somebody on probation? I don't know. You see it tried from time to time. There's very few arbitrator decisions on it. They tend to very much disapprove of it. Once you're on probation, you're off probation, period. An employer can't discipline you and somehow take away your job protections. But this is Virginia, and that's what happens. So they're put on 6 months probation. Chief isn't through with them, though. Several weeks later, he alters the qualifications for promotion to prohibit officers who are on probation from participating in the promotional process. So Liverman and Richards, when they put in their applications for open sergeant positions, the department says, nope, you're ineligible because we just put you on probation. So that's enough for them. They bring a free speech lawsuit, goes through a trial court, federal trial court in Virginia, and ends up before the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, an aside here about the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. There are 13 federal courts of appeals, the first through the 11th Circuit, and then the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals, and then the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. There's 13 of them. And the politics of these circuit courts of appeals have dramatically changed over the course of the last year, 8 years, when we had President Obama. And when I say politics here, I'm just focusing on, you know, my little narrow issue of public safety labor relations and the rights of firefighters, police officers, and corrections officers. 8 years ago, before President Obama had his first appointment to the Fourth Circuit, I would have characterized the Fourth Circuit as the most employer-friendly federal court in the country. Employees couldn't win a case in the Fourth Circuit, and they lost some spectacular cases in the Fourth Circuit. So, for example, the Fourth Circuit had held that a newly elected sheriff could fire everybody in the department who didn't support him, right down to a records clerk. And blessed that form of political patronage that would not be blessed in other parts of the country. Fourth Circuit, very, very pro-employer. But there were a lot of vacancies on the Fourth Circuit, and President Obama's appointments to the Fourth Circuit have completely altered the view of that court towards employment cases. And now it is one of the more employee-friendly courts out there. Witness a decision a few months ago that Fairfax County, also from Virginia, Fairfax County mid-level supervisors in the fire department were eligible for overtime under the FLSA. The old Fourth Circuit never would have ruled that way. New Fourth Circuit definitely is ruling that way. Is that going to swing under President Trump? Sure. It appears that the Heritage Foundation, which is this Koch brothers conservative think tank, is having an outsized influence on President Trump's judicial appointments. You can expect to see these courts shift back to being a fundamentally pro-employer. Okay, that aside, done. Let's get to the Fourth Circuit's opinion. Fourth Circuit says, unconstitutional rule on social media. Court starts by saying, look, we don't underestimate the ability of social media to amplify workplace conduct and to have some sort of disruptive effects on the workplace. But that doesn't mean that an employer, a public employer, can cut off all discourse about matters of public interest. After all, says the court, government employees are often in the best position of anybody to know what the problems are that are facing the agencies for which they work. A policy like that in Petersburg cuts all of that short. It quashes speech on matters of public import even before it happens. It quashes that speech at the outset. Now, what's the chief's explanation for the discipline, the probation and the oral reprimands? The chief's argument was that the divisive use of social media undermines the department's legitimate interests in maintaining camaraderie among officers and building community trust. And the court says, hey, those are legitimate interests. But there's a failure of proof in this case. And what's the failure of proof? And here I'll quote from the court's opinion. The department fails to satisfy its burden of demonstrating actual disruption to its mission. Apart from the generalized allegations of budding divisiveness and claims that some patrol officers sought shift transfers, the chief presented no evidence of any material disruption arising from the officer's comments on social media. We don't deny that officer social media use might present some potential for division in the ranks, particularly given the broad audience on Facebook. But the speculative ills targeted by the social networking policy are not sufficient to justify sweeping restrictions on officers' freedoms to debate matters of public concern. What the court is really worried about here, and you see courts worried about this all the time, is that policies that restrict speech, whether it's social media or other form of speech, policies that restrict speech too broadly deprive the public of needed information about public concern. It's a recognition, as the court said, that public employees, particularly public safety employees, may have more information about matters that should concern us as a body politic than anybody else. They're the line troops. They're on the ground. They understand. For example, in the context of this case in Petersburg, they understand the implications of making a two-year police officer a field training officer. Those are the sorts of observations. That's the sort of speech that the First Amendment is designed to cultivate and encourage, not prohibit it. Now, let me end my discussion of this case with what I think is just some wonderful writing from the Fourth Circuit on this whole issue of social media policies. Listen to these three sentences from the court. Four sentences. Running a police department is hard work. Its mission requires capable, top-down leadership and a cohesion and esprit de corps on the part of the officers under the chief's command. And yet the difficulty of the task and the need for appropriate disciplinary measures to perform it still does not allow police departments to wall themselves off from public scrutiny and debate. That's what happened here. The sensitivity of all the well-known issues that surround every police department in this country makes such lack of transparency an unhealthy state of affairs. So what do we take from this case? First of all, the obvious is that broad social media policies much more likely to be held unconstitutional than those that are targeted at specific types of communications. The second takeaway is that if an employer wants to use as a justification for a social media policy the notion that there is disruption in the workplace that comes from the comments made by officers, that's going to be a fact-specific inquiry. We're going to look at the comments, and we are going to look at what the department can prove about the actual, not speculative, disruption in the workplace that resulted from those comments. Those are the two big takeaways from this case. Again, not new law. This has been around a long time, but I love it when a case like this gets a lot of publicity, and it serves as a wonderful platform for reviewing what the law is. The last case I want to talk about is a labor case. Comes out of Michigan, comes out of the Michigan Employment Relations Commission, and in particular an administrative law judge there. And it raises a question that you see come up from time to time, really with a fair amount of regularity. And the question is, does a union have a right to independently tape record an internal affairs interview or a disciplinary interview? And the easy answer to that question is yes, if you've got something in your state law or a collective bargaining agreement that specifically allows the union to make such a recording. So for example, there are some state peace officer Bill of Rights, public safety employee Bill of Rights, that allow tape recording of interviews. And certainly if it's in that sort of statute, you'd have the right to for the union to tape record an interview. There are many collective bargaining agreements, even in states without statewide Peace Officer Bill of Rights, that give the right to tape record. What this Michigan case is all about is in the absence of any of those things, in the absence of a statewide Peace Officer's Bill of Rights, or in the absence of a controlling collective bargaining agreement provision, is there the right to tape record an investigatory interview? And this administrative law judge, it's a case involving Kent County, and the situation in Kent County was the employer actually didn't realize the union was tape recording the interviews, found out about it, and issued an order forbidding the union from tape recording the interviews. And the administrative law judge who heard the union's unfair labor practice complaint that challenged that order had to decide, is there something in the union's right to act as a representative for its members that gives the right to tape record interviews? And following the rules that you see in other states, this isn't the first time this issue has come up, even though the administrative law judge doesn't refer to the law in other states, but nonetheless, he reaches the same result. The administrative law judge answers that question, no, there is no right to tape record unless you bargain for it or unless it's in a statewide peace officer's Bill of Rights. And the administrative law judge's rationale is that the purpose of the union rep being at an investigatory interview is to make sure that the representative is there to counsel the member, is there to act as a, in the words of the ALJ in this case, active advocate on behalf of the member. The act of tape recording, says the administrative law judge, is an advocacy on behalf of the bargaining unit member. Now, the union's response to that was, well, yeah, look, but if we can't record, I keep saying tape recording, nobody's using tape anymore. If we can't record these interviews, we have to take handwritten notes, and that gets in the way of us being as good an advocate as we possibly can be. And Here's the administrative law judge's answer to that. He says, here, there's no argument by the union that a bargaining unit member was ever denied representation at an investigatory interview, or that the representative was ever denied the opportunity to act as an active advocate. While the union argues that because its representatives are unable to make a tape recording and must instead take handwritten notes, they're prevented from doing the best possible job in their role as an advocate, there's no right under the collective bargaining law that employees receive the best representation possible. I think the ALJ could have probably worded that a little bit differently, right? I think the ALJ probably could have held that the act of representation doesn't necessarily include the ability to record an interview. I think going as far as saying employees aren't entitled to receive the best representation possible probably goes a little bit too far. But the underlying result that unions don't have the right to record disciplinary interviews, that's not a surprise. That's what the majority rule is in the country. Now, I do want to discuss just for a little bit the union's last argument in the case, which I found pretty fascinating. The union said, look, without regard to our ability to provide effective representation for our members, this employer policy of no recording interferes with our ability to conduct our own internal affairs as a union. How so? The union says that a vital part of its internal administration is to take whatever measures it can to protect itself from liability and paying damages to a member who might bring a duty of fair representation claim against the union. And, of course, we can defend ourselves better if we have recordings of the interviews. How does the ALJ deal with that? Well, he doesn't like it. He says, while I agree with the union's premise that protecting itself from liability is important and necessary for its internal administration, I disagree that prohibiting the union from recording interviews with or prevents the union from doing so. So, the moral of this story, and I guess this moral is directed more at unions than anybody else, the moral of this story, and I'll have a sub-moral in a moment, but the moral is, if you want the ability to record interviews and you don't have it under a Bill of Rights, you're going to have to negotiate for it. You're going to have to get it into your collective bargaining agreement. What's the sub-moral? Well, there's a cautionary tale here for employers. I want to spin something out for you. Let's assume that in Kent County, the local union shows up and puts a recorder down on the table and says to the employer, we want to record this interview. And the employer says, no, you can't record the interview. And then the investigation continues. The employee is interviewed. The employee is disciplined. And something happens to the employer's recording. It disappears, it's accidentally erased, it's purged pursuant to some public records policy, whatever it might be. The employer's recording goes away. And there's an arbitration or a court challenge to the employee's discipline. What happens in those circumstances? Well, the absence of a recording in those cases is going to be construed against the employer. Because, of course, the union was right there saying, hey, we do want to record this, and there would have been an alternative to simply relying on the employer's recording. There's many times when you face issues in the law where the question is not so much whether an employer or a union can do something, but rather the question is whether it should do something. Why would an employer forbid a union from recording disciplinary interviews? What's the upside to that? Assuming the union isn't you know, turning around and posting those interviews on Facebook and assuming that the union does just use them for its own internal purposes. Why take that risk? Why take that risk that you might end up losing a disciplinary case somewhere down the road because something has happened to a recording? And I've had those cases, by the way. Why take that risk? What's the marginal harm that gets caused by the union recording as well as the employer? I don't know. Never understood that quite. Anyway, that's it for this month's First Thursday. Thank you for bearing with us, particularly how this whole process goes together. We look forward to seeing you at an upcoming seminar. We've got one in April in Las Vegas. Come to our website, LRAS.com. Our seminar is on collective bargaining for public safety employees. We've got a great lineup of speakers. I'm going to spend some time at the start of that seminar talking about settlement trends and the early impacts of the Trump administration on the public safety workplace. It's be great to come see you there. In the meantime, this is Will Aitchison signing off. Thanks for joining us.